Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman and welcome to What Women Must Know. You know, I always like to say the purpose of the show is empowering you with truthful information so you can make informed choices. And I am a firm believer if we don't have an open mind, if we don't have a willingness to examine all possibilities, we don't know what could be the best path, healing path, path of transformation in our own lives, and for our family and loved ones as well. So I'm so glad you're joining me today because I have another very profound, life-changing conversation with my guest, Dr. Georgia E. We're talking about change your diet, change your mind. And the more that I personally investigate the role of diet and how diet changes your perception of reality, your own sense of self, the more critical it is to understand what can bring us, what diet choices can really bring us to a greater level of health, vitality, and mental and emotional well-being. So that's what we're talking about today. And my guest is really on a mission here. So let me just share a little bit about Dr. Eve, including many years as a college psychiatrist and nutrition consultant at Smith College and Harvard University Health Services. Dr. Georgia Eve was the first psychiatrist to offer nutrition-based approaches as alternative to conventional care for students, faculty, and staff. She uses nutrition and metabolic interventions, including paleo diets, ketogenic diets, intermittent fasting, and elimination diets to help people around the world address the root causes of mental health conditions, improving their metabolic health, and often reducing their need for psychiatric medication. Dr. Eve speaks internationally about dietary approaches to psychiatric disorders, nutrition science, and nutrition policy reform. She is also the creator and director of the first medically accredited course in ketogenic diets for mental health practitioners. In 2022, she co-authored the first inpatient study of the ketogenic diet for serious mental health illnesses and was honored to be named a recipient of the Suzuki Brain Research Fund's first annual Metabolic Mind Award. And her latest book and best-selling book is called Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, which I hope everyone will get a copy of. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Georgia E. to What Women Must Know. Georgia, it's so great having you on the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Cheryl. It's really a pleasure to be with you.
You know, this is a huge transformational journey that you have embarked upon in your work. And we were just chatting a little before the show. I'm here in Australia, and I can tell you that every day on the news or in the newspaper, there is headline stories about the huge mental health crisis happening in Australia and the huge incidence of crimes committed by youth. And, you know, the questions are, how much do you lock them up? How long do you lock them up? These 13 and 14-year-olds are stealing cars. They're bashing people. They're, you know, threatening, life-threatening home invasions going on. And I really think that the community here is totally stymied as to what to do. You know, locking these kids up isn't going to look at and address the real problem. But that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about, how do we create healthy mental well-being in all of us, in all of us? So, Georgia, you know, what always interests me when I have my conversations with my guests is to know what was the epiphany moment that happened in your life, or epiphany moments that may have happened, that transformed you as a psychiatrist, and we all know psychiatrists are well briefed into the use of medication. That's what you do when you go to a psychiatrist these days, for the most part. And you were so traditionally trained in Harvard. What happened to you along the way?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's true. I mean, I was conventionally trained. I was trained to prescribe medications and to offer psychotherapy to people who were coming to me for help with various types of conditions. And I did that for about 10 years. And I did enjoy doing that. I mean, it was really hard work and sometimes pretty heartbreaking work because, you know, this is, I think, true of most psychiatric practices. My practice was filling up with patients who just weren't getting that much better. And so that was really frustrating. And, you know, so no matter how hard I worked, how hard my colleagues worked, and all of us were working really hard, we couldn't seem to get most of our patients better enough. And so, and it's also frustrating because prescribing medicine, in, at least in the field of psychiatry, we're practicing really in the dark. We don't have any good tests that we can offer you if you come for help with depression or anxiety or attention problems, mood swings, memory issues. We don't have any tests that can tell us, you know, with any degree of certainty what's going on with your brain chemistry. And so we can't tell you with any certainty what kinds of medicines or other treatments are going to be the ones that are most worth trying. And so we end up with this trial and error process, kind of practicing in the dark of trying to find some combination of medicines that might be helpful. And so what changed for me was, you know, I never thought about nutrition and the brain until my own health started to change in my early 40s. You know, I started to have a variety of what I like to call mystery syndromes popping up in my life, you know, things like fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue and IBS and migraines and things like that. And it was starting to interfere with my ability to work. And I went and got all kinds of tests, and I was told everything was normal. I had all kinds of specialists. And, but of course everything wasn't normal. And so I just started experimenting instinctively with my diet. And long story short, after about 6 months, I arrived at a diet that was almost exactly upside down from the diet that we're recommended to eat. But that was the diet that resolved every single one of those physical health issues. And then on top of that, something I wasn't expecting and wasn't hoping for was my mental health was noticeably better, and really better than it ever had been. You know, anxiety, depression, my mood was better, my concentration was better, my mental stamina was better, my thinking was clear, my threshold for anxiety was much higher. I was getting a lot more done. I was more even keeled. It was really noticeable. And I thought to myself, well, this diet seems to be good for the brain. and this, you know, maybe this could help all of my patients who aren't getting better enough. And so lots of my patients were also, in addition to their psychiatric issues, were also struggling with a lot of these same mystery syndromes. And I really had no idea how to help them with those things. So, but I couldn't just prescribe this diet for them, because this diet was mostly animal foods. It was low in fiber, low in plant foods, you know, high in cholesterol, high in fat, high in animal protein, and it was very, very low in carbohydrate. And at the time, I knew nothing about nutrition, and I thought, well, this diet, you know, has solved all of my health problems, but what if this diet in the long run kills me? It would be irresponsible of me to, you know, just recommend this diet to all my patients because it happened to help me. So I had to study nutrition. I studied nutrition. I became obsessed, really, honestly, fascinated by, and I kind of fell in love with nutrition science. I really dove into it independently for years, studied very deeply everything I could learn about nutrition, and I haven't looked back. I mean, I wrote the book partly as a way to share everything I've discovered by studying nutrition, but also by practicing in these very new ways over the past 10 or 12 years that I've been using these principles now for a long time in my work.
So that's quite profound. I mean, that litany of symptoms that you shared, it's quite debilitating to have IBS and chronic fatigue, and, you know, it goes on and on, as well as the brain fog. you know, that's huge. That's a huge change, and something that so many people suffer with at this point. So what did you think was a healthy diet at that stage of your life before you did your research?
Sure. So, you know, I think like most women who grew up with a weight problem, which I did, I most of the women in my family have struggled with weight, and I have been on diets off and on since I was in elementary school. So, you know, I started gaining weight when I was 6 or 7 years old. And this was in the 70s, and I was one of only two girls kids in my class who were overweight. Back then it was very, very uncommon to be overweight. Nowadays it's almost the norm. So it was, you know, it was really challenging, as I think anybody who grows up with a weight problem knows that it's challenging. But like most girls who grew up with a weight problem, I viewed my food choices simply as a way to control my weight or try to control my weight. And the diet I thought was healthiest, and I tried all kinds of diets over the course of my life, the diet I at that point thought was healthiest was the one that I was eating, and it was a high-fiber, low-fat diet it was things like, you know, skinless chicken breast and tofu and soy milk and bran cereals, Diet Coke, big salads, you know, that sort of a diet. And I rarely ate red meat. I rarely added fat to anything. I was very, very careful. I thought I was eating a really healthy diet. And most of my peers thought of me as somebody who ate healthier than most other people my age did. So, I was kind of thought of as somebody who ate healthier. Anyway, and I exercised 6 to 7 days a week really rigorously, you know, running and weight training and all kinds of other things. So I thought that I couldn't have done anything more for my health. I thought I was doing everything I could. And, you know, when I look back at that diet, I think, well, you know, my goodness, first of all, there may not have been enough nutrients in it to begin with, but also, you know, it was very low in fat, very high in fiber, and it had a lot of, you know, diet foods in it. You know, things like sugar-free soy milk and bran cereals and, you know, non-fat yogurt, lettuce, tofu, you know, things. I really was afraid to eat fat because I gained weight so easily. And so that's what I thought was healthy. And that, a very similar diet to that diet, it is what I was advised to eat when I left all of those specialist offices when I was going through all that evaluation for my issues. I was handed the same generic diet handout at every office, you know, high fiber, low fat, avoid red meat, low cholesterol. Those kinds of recommendations were the kinds of recommendations I was leaving all those doctor's offices with, but I was already following those recommendations almost to the letter.
So that sounds like so many people's story, to be honest, including mine for a long time. Like you, I had, you know, challenges and hormonal challenges and weight challenges and thought that going more plant-based, avoiding red meat. I really never ate red meat. I would eat fish or chicken, but I never really ate red meat at all. And, just struggled with thyroid issues and depression. And so I've been there, like so many people have been there, trying to do the right thing. But then we have these epiphany moments where suddenly we have to reevaluate everything. And I guess that's the message I want to share with all my listeners today. If your diet isn't giving you the health results you want or the weight results, and something is wrong, because it should. And this is where we're going to, you know, talk about your exploration and how you were diving into the ketogenic diet. And fortunately, I recently played Dr. Thomas Stacey's interview on the metabolic approach to cancer, interviewed Dr. Anthony Chafee, a neurosurgeon who understands the role of the ketogenic diet. So fortunately for you, that entered into your world. You began to investigate another path that was totally foreign to everything we were taught to believe to be healthy. So how did that happen? And I'm just curious, are you, this is the message you're giving in all the talks you're doing around the world, and you are doing so many presentations, you're so involved in this. What's the response from your peers in these very traditional institutions that you're teaching in?
Yeah, so I am very fortunate to, as you said, you have been able to give presentations in many places around the world, and they're usually presentations where people in the audiences are already open to these ideas. So most of the places that I'm presenting, the ideas are really welcome. And then I'm also really fortunate to teach this training program to clinicians around the world, ketogenic diets for mental health. And those clinicians, of course, are coming to the program because they're already really excited about these ideas and using these tools in their practices. But then where I really see the most skepticism and the most reluctance to even consider these different ways of working with patients is in my clinical work. So what happens in my clinical work is that, I'm trying to help patients by changing their diets in these different ways. And really the cornerstone of my diet, of my practice, the diet that's most useful, the most powerful tool I have in my toolbox for helping people with their mental health is a ketogenic diet. And, of course, that diet is very, very different from the diet that's recommended in, nutrition guidelines and in most nutrition headlines and so forth. So when I recommend this diet to my patients and they go to their primary care doctor or they go to their local psychiatrist, or sometimes I'm consulting, to a team which already has a psychiatrist, a conventionally trained psychiatrist on the team, or primary care doctor, et cetera, that's where I see most of the skepticism and reluctance is that patient's other clinical team members being worried that the diet is dangerous, being afraid, to support the diet because they don't know a lot about it or think it may be dangerous, for their patients. And also, so many clinicians, I mean, especially physicians, as you know, we're very conservative. We're taught to be very conservative in our approaches to patients because, we feel responsible. We feel responsible if something goes wrong. And so we really like to have the backing of guidelines. We like to have the backing of institutions and standards so that we can say, well, I prescribed this therapy because this is the therapy that most of my peers have agreed is the right way to practice, or this particular institution or this particular academy or this particular school of thought or these 20 randomized controlled trials of this medication have shown to be the right way to do this. So we like to practice in that comfort zone and for good reason. But the problem is that there is no nutritional standard of care in psychiatry. So because it's not a topic that's taught or even thought about in medical school or psychiatry residency training programs, so we really don't have any guidelines to go by. So most people fall back, most clinicians fall back on the general nutrition recommendations, which are the diet should be, 40 to 60% carbohydrate. Most of that should be whole grains and legumes and plants, and it should be low in saturated fat. It should be low in red meat. It should be a diet that's balanced, so-called balanced, and it should be a diet that's not too high in cholesterol. And so lots of these recommendations they're not grounded in science at all, which is something that I explain in the book. But they're also, for many of my patients, most of my patients, they're a serious obstacle to my prescribing a ketogenic diet, because a ketogenic diet is extremely low in carbohydrate. contains ideally no grains at all. And could be high in plants, could be low in plants, but it's certainly not going to contain a rainbow of fruits and vegetables, because when you include a wide variety of fruits and vegetables, the carbohydrate content will be too high to allow the body to burn fat and provide and energize the brain with ketones. So that's where I see the most pushback, is in conventional care. So we have a lot of work to do there, because we need new treatments for people with psychiatric conditions. The treatments that we have fail most people. We need to help clinicians in this space understand that these are really wonderful, really hopeful, potentially very effective treatments for people with mental health conditions of just about every kind.
Yeah, such a huge undertaking. One of my previous guests was Robert Lutzig, who I'm sure you know about.
Mm-hmm.
He has been
for
decades, warning that the way our diet has been hijacked by big agri, by big food, and put into place all of these carbohydrate, sugary products and drinks, is truly hijacking our health and well-being. And, you know, that's been his mission. God bless him, because he's done it for so many decades. You know, it's David and Goliath kind of mission in life. But we have been sold a bill of goods when it comes to what we've been taught is healthy and nourishing and will support our well-being. And unfortunately, we've been hijacked is the only way to say it. You know, there have been industries that have pushed this and have altered the science and have promoted it in all sorts of ways to get us to change from a traditional diet that our grandparents, I'm sure most of our grandparents, ate a more ketogenic diet, to do this high sugar, high carbohydrate diet, which is wreaking havoc on our mental, physical, emotional health. And I haven't met many people who've been on psychiatric drugs who've really, truly benefited without having to deal with a lot of side effects, which is what's so upsetting to me. And what was really upsetting to me, Georgia, because I've worked with women's health for so many years, when I saw that the trend was to make PMS a psychiatric condition, which was then qualified to be prescribed antidepressants for women were having severe PMS, right? PMDD, they called it. So that was like the last thing that just kind of got me crazy. It's like, let's talk about a ketogenic diet for people listening who may not know what that is all about. Let's describe it a bit so people can appreciate why that's such an effective diet and why there's so much research and investigation and so many people who are now turning their, you know, their choices over to a ketogenic diet and getting the benefits, the health benefits.
Yes. So, there are a lot of diets in the world, low-fat diets, low-calorie diets, Mediterranean diets, plant-based diets, lots of different types of diets in the world. But the ketogenic diet is really unique in that it's not, it changes, it fundamentally changes metabolism. So it energizes the brain and body differently. So it's really a very powerful metabolic and biochemical intervention. So, and the way it works is that a typical ketogenic diet is extremely low in carbohydrate, typically around 20 grams of carbohydrate per day. And to give your listeners a context for that, a typical diet that's recommended and that most of us eat would contain roughly 300 or more grams of carbohydrate per day. So it's extremely low in carbohydrate compared to the standard. And it's moderate in protein, so it meets your protein requirements. It's not excessive in protein. It's not, you know, you don't need to eat pounds and pounds of meat per day. Just the right amount of protein. And that protein can come from plants or animals, your choice. And then all of those calories that would normally come from carbohydrate are coming instead from fat. So the body needs to energize itself either with mainly with carbohydrates or mainly with fat. A ketogenic diet is so low in carbohydrates that it brings your insulin levels down. Insulin, the carbohydrates raise insulin the most, and protein to a lesser degree, and then fat, pure fat, barely touches insulin at all. So when you lower your carbohydrate and raise your fat and keep your protein somewhere in the middle, the insulin levels come down. They come all the way down to a point where you cross this threshold and insulin levels come down low enough that fat burning turns on. So insulin, we think of insulin as a blood sugar regulator, as it's sort of a to help manage diabetes, for example, so it keeps your blood sugar down. But insulin is actually a master metabolic hormone, a growth hormone, actually, and it's conducting the activity of lots of other hormones in the body. And one of the things it does, when insulin levels are high, it turns off fat burning. So you cannot burn fat if your insulin levels are too high. So by following a ketogenic diet, you bring your carbohydrate down so low that insulin levels come down low enough to allow fat burning to switch on. And when you're burning fat vigorously enough, the liver will turn some of that fat, will break that fat down into even smaller pieces called ketones. And those ketones can travel throughout the circulation and cross the blood-brain barrier and enter the brain and help to energize the brain. And so this is really a godsend for the majority of us now who have insulin resistance or prediabetes or metabolic dysfunction or metabolic syndrome or whatever you want to call it. We have an epidemic now, a worldwide epidemic of insulin resistance. And all that means is the body and brain are becoming insulin resistant because we have been flooding our system with too much insulin for too long. So when your insulin levels are running too high too often, the body and the brain naturally become resistant to that insulin to kind of protect themselves from being bombarded by too much insulin. And the brain is no exception. So what happens is by flooding your system with too much carbohydrate, especially too many of the wrong carbohydrates, too often the refined carbohydrates, sugars, flours, cereals, fruit juices, 6 times a day in most cases, you know, breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks, your insulin levels run too high, the brain becomes insulin resistant. So now glucose, blood sugar, will still be able to waltz into the brain, no questions asked. But insulin is going to have a harder and harder time getting in. And that's a really serious problem because the brain can't turn glucose into energy to full capacity efficiently and properly without adequate insulin. So your brain can be swimming in a sea of glucose and still be slowly starving to death. And these energy deficits are one of the many reasons why a diet like that is going to gradually pave your path to all kinds of mental health problems. And we now see evidence of insulin resistance in a wide variety of psychiatric conditions. And the evidence is strongest in bipolar disorder and Alzheimer's disease. But you also see evidence of insulin resistance in anxiety disorders and major depression, in schizophrenia, in PTSD, in certain forms of OCD, in children with anxiety disorders. Insulin resistance goes hand in hand at a much higher rate with these conditions than people who don't have these conditions. So we're just starting to understand. So now a ketogenic diet rescues the brain from that energy slump. What's happening is the brain's ability to process glucose slows down, becomes sluggish, more and more sluggish over time. The longer you have insulin resistance, the more sluggish your brain glucose processing becomes. And so what happens then is, let's say that you're on the path to Alzheimer's disease. By the time you notice any memory problems at all, you've already lost up to 25% of your brain's glucose processing capacity. You need an alternative fuel source, and really the only option you have at that point is ketones. And so if you're not eating a ketogenic diet, your brain will not be properly energized. And without enough energy, the brain cannot function properly. And so this is one of the unique benefits of a ketogenic diet. It's the only diet that can keep you in that state of ketosis long-term, safely, and control your appetite and help improve the metabolic health of the rest of your body as well. So it's really very special in that way. No other diet other than an extremely low-calorie diet, which is hard to sustain for very long, is going to be able to get you into that special metabolic state.
Wow, you know, that's so profound. I was watching a presentation that you had on your website, and you were giving statistics about Alzheimer's. And, you know, I have people in my life who are starting to notice that their, you know, their mental sharpness is declining and forgetfulness. And the fear is there that they are, you know, progressing into a more chronic condition like Alzheimer's, which unfortunately they probably are. So what are those statistics about what's happening in this epidemic of mental decline and Alzheimer's, you know, diagnoses?
It really is grim. You know, 80% of people with Alzheimer's disease have insulin resistance. And the more insulin resistant you are, the more sluggish your brain glucose processing is. And that energy deficit, you know, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative disease, and all that means is that brain cells are dying. And they're not, it's not as though they start dying overnight when you get your diagnosis. This process takes place over very slowly, very silently over decades. So they've seen, you can document, using special brain imaging tests called PET scans. You can look directly at glucose processing in the brain with these special scans. And they've seen evidence of sluggish brain glucose processing in women in their early 20s who have insulin resistance. These are young women who, unbeknownst to them, are already on the path to Alzheimer's disease in their early 20s. And so, and I don't know how many times I heard this. I mean, I worked in college mental health, as you were mentioning in the introduction, for, 12, 13 years, different settings, different universities. And I can't tell you how many times students would say to me, I feel like my memory isn't as good as it was in high school. And that's the kind of memory, subtle memory issue that's not going to show up on testing because it's too subtle, but they know they're not as sharp as they used to be. Even it's really interesting. And a lot of times they'll say, well, I have ADHD, I need a stimulant, I can't concentrate, I can't get as much work done, I have a really hard time struggling, it's taking me a lot longer to get my work done. And so there are lots of different ways that that eating a poor diet can contribute to that lack of mental power, and one of them is insulin resistance. So, you know, people with Alzheimer's disease, they, by the time they notice memory problems, we said, you know, their brain glucose processing can already be reduced by 25%, but also their hippocampus, the size of their hippocampus, which is the brain's learning and memory center, can already have shrunk by 10%, and that's due to cell death. So what's killing those cells? What's killing those cells is that they're being starved for energy. They're also being directly physically damaged by waves and waves and waves of inflammation and something called oxidative stress, which is why we're told we're supposed to eat so many antioxidant-rich foods. Inflammation and oxidative stress, and how does the diet relate to those things? Lots of different ways, but the most important ways are refined carbohydrates, sugar, flour, cereals, fruit juices, all the things that most people are eating multiple times per day, and refined vegetable oils like soybean oil. These are the signature ingredients of modern unhealthy diets that are literally destroying our brains from the inside out. And if all people do is remove those ultra processed foods that are built on those signature ingredients, they're already going to be so much healthier than everyone else around them. That's absolutely step one.
That's, you know, such an overwhelming picture of what's happening. It's like because how our diet has been hijacked and how we have been lied to and deceived and pushed into this direction, it's like our culture, any culture that's taken on a Western diet, it's like marching to the edge of a cliff when it comes to their health, because it's just staggering the statistics with Alzheimer's, dementia, with diabetes, with all what's called non-chronic diseases, like fibromyalgia, like you had, IBS, all caused by eating the wrong diet, too high in sugars, carbs, and creating the insulin resistance in the body. That's just, you know, it's such a big story. So let's clarify a few things for people. So the ketogenic diet has been well researched. There's lots of research going on to the ketogenic diet and its benefits. And two components of a ketogenic diet is to include more protein, but the emphasis is the importance of fat. Now, everyone has been trimming off the fat from the lamb. It's trimmed off, thrown away. It's like the devil is self-destroying your health. So we have become a lean, fat lean culture. You know, we're phobic about our fat because we're told they're so harmful and dangerous and will kill us, great heart disease. So enlighten us, Georgia, what's the truth about fats and their importance in our
Oh my goodness! So fat is a very important macronutrient. It also contains micronutrients, fat soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K. And when it comes from animals, it also contains omega 3 and omega 6 fatty acids, which are critical for brain health, especially during the first 1,000 days of life when the brain is rapidly developing. And so the other interesting thing about fat, I mean, I know it sounds, I mean, I believe this for decades myself. It sounds so simple and so logical that eating too much fat should make you fat, but that's not the way the body sees it. The body, you know, if you eat more food, more than you need, the body will store that extra as fat, and it will do that whether you're eating too much fat or whether you're eating too much carbohydrate. It doesn't care. And so if you eat more carbohydrate than you need, then you can store, we can store very little carbohydrate. We store a little bit in our muscles. We store a little bit in our liver as starch called glycogen. We can't store that much carbohydrate in our bodies. We are designed as animals. Plants store energy as carbohydrate in giant lumps of starch and underground, like potatoes and root vegetables. Those are big lumps of stored energy for plants. But humans and other animals, we can't store energy as starch. It would be impractical. We'd have to carry these enormous lumps of starch around behind us wherever we went. We carry lightweight, compact, flexible, saturated fat. Saturated fat is what our body turns every extra gram of carbohydrate that you need that you can't burn or store in that moment. If you eat even one extra gram of carbohydrate than you can use in that moment, the body will turn it on purpose into saturated fat and store it in your body. And so you could eat zero molecules of fat for the next 10 years and still weigh 400 pounds. Because that's how the body works. And so it's not fat that makes us fat. It's high insulin levels that make us fat. So insulin is a growth hormone. When insulin is high, it's telling you to grow and store. It's telling you, okay, cells should divide. We should make new components, and any energy that we don't need right away, when your insulin levels are high, it is going to make fat. Insulin turns on fat storage enzymes, and low insulin turns them off, turns on fat burning. So if you construct your diet in a way that keeps your insulin levels in a healthy range, that avoids those insulin spikes that come from refined carbohydrates or eating too much carbohydrate for your personal metabolism, or just eating too much food in general, more than you need. Your insulin levels will run too high, and you will be in fat storage mode. Your body and brain won't even know, won't be able to access that fat. You could have 300 pounds of extra body fat on your frame, and you will not be able to access it if your insulin levels are too high. And that's lots and lots of stored energy. So what makes us fat is insulin levels that are running too high. It's really as simple as that. So the most effective way to lower your insulin levels is with a ketogenic diet.
And you know, I can testify to that because I've always had challenges with my weight, just wanting to get it down to a more trim body. And I struggled with that. And then when I started doing this ketogenic diet and putting in more fat and more protein, you know, within a month, 6 weeks, I've lost, you know, 10 pounds effortlessly. And I don't have hunger anymore. I'm satisfied with one meal a day because that's the other side of this ketogenic diet with fat. It satiates you. It helps to activate the hormone, which is called leptin, which lets you know when you're full and satisfied. Most people have that damaged, so they never feel full and they're always hungry and always wanting to, you know, scout the fridge or whatever. It's been so interesting. And there's one other thing I just want to share. I just was reading some information last night about alcohol. So alcohol, when you drink alcohol, it has an effect to store fat and to lose muscle mass. So the more you drink alcohol, the more you are increasing your, you know, your insulin levels. But you're also destroying and eliminating your muscle mass. So you're getting fatter and flabbier, but this, if you've worked hard in the gym to build your muscle mass, it gets destroyed with alcohol. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I mean, the things that I talk about in the book about alcohol, is, you know, that alcohol, you know, we've been told for such a long time that the Mediterranean diet, which is supposed to be paired with a nice glass of red wine, you know, every night, that red wine is one of the healthy components of a Mediterranean diet, and a Mediterranean diet is supposed to be healthiest for the brain. And but there's no science behind that, and I tear that apart in the book, of course, but help people understand that red wine is not a brain healthy beverage. It's not a healthy beverage at all, full stop. And that's because some of what you were just saying about how it's metabolized, when the liver sees alcohol coming in, it stops everything else it's doing to process that alcohol and detoxify it and get rid of it. And that's it views it as a top priority toxin and processes it as a toxin. And so one of the things the liver stops doing when alcohol is coming through is it stops making new glucose molecules and putting them into the blood. And it also stops burning fat. And because it can't do all of those things at once, it has to make choices. And because alcohol is so toxic, it prioritizes breaking down the alcohol and stops breaking down fat until every molecule of that alcohol is dealt with first. So, and of course, alcohol is a very powerful promoter of oxidative stress, and which is one of the things that we're trying to fight with a ketogenic diet. And one of the reasons why we're always told to eat more colorful plant foods full of antioxidants, because we have too much oxidative stress. We're never told to stop consuming the things that are causing that excessive oxidative stress in the first place, including alcohol, including refined carbohydrates. And, of course, smoking is another common cause of oxidative stress. So, you know, you're exactly right that alcohol is a really important component of the diet to pay attention to if you care about your mental health and your physical health.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, which, you know, so many people don't want to hear, but it's an important message. And the other one that I've changed is I used to look first thing in the morning, getting up and out and going to my local cafe and having a morning coffee, a latte, whatever, coffee. And, you know, I've shared with people on my program before that I am dealing with a cancer diagnosis, a serious one, a brain tumor, which I just want to let everyone know I'm doing well. So far, so good. But what I've been learning is that, you know, coffee, as much as it is an addiction, and I admit it was an addiction for me, it was like I get out into a good early morning out of the house place. But my God, it destroys your zinc levels. It raises your glycemic index and has an effect on your blood sugar. It depletes so many of your key nutrients that I've stopped. I've had to stop. I realized I can't afford to do coffee anymore because it's so debilitating on the nutritional status of my body that it has to go. So it has. It has.
Well, I congratulate you on making that change. It's not easy to do. I mean, I think that's one of the coffee, of course, caffeine is a drug. It's an addictive substance. It's a psychoactive substance. And it's probably the most widely used psychoactive substance in the world. And, you know, it does have profound effects on brain chemistry, on metabolism, on sleep, on anxiety levels, on mood. And it can be really destabilizing for stress hormone levels throughout the day, glucose levels throughout the day, appetite hormones throughout the day. And it interferes with a brain hormone, a brain neurotransmitter called adenosine, which is our sleep promoting neurotransmitter. So, it can disrupt sleep quality, especially because, the half-life, you know, it can take, 16 to 24 hours for to have caffeine completely clear your system in some cases. And so for some people, it's even a small serving of caffeine in the morning can disrupt their sleep quality that night. So it is something I'm glad you brought up, because as hard as it is to do that experiment, I think it's really worth doing to see how much of a role it's playing in your life. I'm curious to know, you were sharing with me about your diagnosis before we got on the call, and I'm so, so glad to hear that you're doing well. I'm curious to know, when you removed coffee, did you notice anything and different? Was better, worse? Was it difficult? Anything improve?
Well, it's been about maybe 2 weeks or so. It hasn't been very long, but I thought it would be the most difficult thing to change. But actually, it hasn't been, and it feels like I'm free from an addiction, that I don't have to go and do this to get going in the morning and feel good. And I can still go out, socialize at my cafe, but have a cup of green tea, right? So it's just changing habits. But I feel that it's a really good thing for my overall program that I'm creating for health. And what also goes along with that, that I wanted to touch upon, which was a revelation for me too, because I can't say I was plant-based. I had my vegetarian era in my life, you know, and then tried to eat meals that are more balanced with more protein along vegetables. But what I've come to learn based on this, you know, delving into the cancer world, is how important protein is, adequate protein is to protect against cancer. Protein, if you're deficient in protein, then you are setting a condition up in your body that can help promote the growth of cancer. I didn't know that. I was deficient in protein when I did, and I had blood chemistry done. I was very deficient in my protein levels, and that is a risk factor for cancer for all of us if we have low protein. And, you know, so people who are vegetarian, vegans, going in that direction and not doing any animal products, you're not getting the comprehensive nutritional status found in meat and only in meat. So do you want to take that ball and run with it, Georgia?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and even going beyond protein, right, that there are these molecules, there are these nutrients, some of them essential. Some of them that are called conditionally essential, meaning under many circumstances, we may not be able to make enough of our own, so we need to get them from our diet. Some are essential. We have to get them from our diet. These essential and conditionally essential micronutrients, there's so many of them in animal foods that are difficult or impossible to obtain enough of from plants. And in some cases, we can't obtain any at all from plants. And so these nutrients, in addition to the high quality mix of amino acids that's missing, fall short in most plant protein sources, there are all these precious micronutrients, omega-3 fatty acids and zinc and iron and choline. I could go on and on. So there are iodine is another really important one that is often overlooked. There are lots of these critical micronutrients that most people who are following a vegan diet are not supplementing properly. And this isn't to suggest that, that supplementing a vegan diet will be as good as getting those nutrients from whole foods, such as animal foods. But I think people who are choosing a vegan diet are often, unfortunately, and I've got a chapter in the book about plant-based diets, unfortunately, the messages that they're receiving from nutrition authorities and influencers often downplay or dismiss these other very real micronutrient issues that go beyond B12. And so most vegans know, to supplement B12, and many know that they need to plan carefully to try to meet their amino acid needs, but most of them are not getting the right information about these many other essential and conditionally essential nutrients that, are required for optimum function. We don't just want to get by. We want optimum function for all of our cells. And so that does concern me, especially women, especially young women. These are the people who are often choosing vegan and vegetarian diets for compassionate reasons. And there's a world of difference between vegan and vegetarian diets. It is possible to construct a healthy vegetarian diet. It's much, much more difficult to construct a complete vegan diet.
So these are such important revelations that we're sharing today. The importance of fat. Don't trim your fat. Have your fat on your meat. What other forms of fats do you recommend if you're on a ketogenic diet, other than animal fats, which I think are really important because your brain is driven. It grows from fat. That's unnecessary for a healthy brain, so that's important for me right now. But what other fats can people choose to include in their diet that would be beneficial?
Yeah, really any fat that comes from a whole plant or animal food is okay in my book, but that's not most of what we're eating. Most of what we're eating these days is refined fats, vegetable oils in particular, that we're told are good for us. This sometimes makes me very upset. The healthiest fats are fats from whole foods. So let's think about the animal fats. It could be, for example, the fat from a cut of meat or the fats in egg yolks. Those are good examples. Fats from fish, and then from plant foods, it could be the fats that are naturally found in avocados or olives or nuts, right? But unfortunately, because we're told to avoid animal fat, because we're told, as you were saying, to trim the fat off our animal foods, to eat lean proteins. If we're going to eat animal foods, we should eat lean meats, chicken without the skin, white meats instead of red meats, and on and on. Because we're told to minimize the animal fat in our diet, most of the fat, especially if you're eating a lot of processed foods, which many people are, most of the fat in our processed foods is now coming from vegetable oils. And vegetable oils are, and I don't think that this is a stretch to say this, I do think that they are toxic. And this is the opposite. This is upside down from what we're told. These are not healthy for the brain or the body. These are completely unnecessary to include in the human diet. We have no dietary requirement for them. And so they are all risk and no benefit. So that, I think, I mean, even for people who think of themselves as eating a very healthy diet, like they might, if they go out to lunch, they might have a salad. But what are they going to put on? They're going to put on dressing from the restaurant. Or they might buy a dressing in the grocery store. I mean, 95% of dressings you find in restaurants and grocery stores are full of vegetable oil. That's just one example. And so you take on that. You know, yeah, they're absolutely toxic. Yes.
So we only have about a minute left. So let me just refer people to your website. You have some great information, some lectures there. DiagnosisDiet.com is George's website. DiagnosisDiet.com. And again, if you really want to delve into this and change your life, change your mental health status, change your thinking, change your memory, change your pain, your arthritis, change your weight, then you need to pick up a copy of George's book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind, which is the best-selling book right now. It has all the answers in there. And, it's time for all of us to wake up. You don't have to wait for a serious health diagnosis like I did to get on the right path to health, right? This is, if you're listening to this, there's a message here for you. So take heed. It will change your life. It will absolutely change your life. So, Georgia, thank you so much for doing such a great job helping people understand this journey we're on to better health. And congratulations again on the success of your book, Change Your Diet, Change Your Mind. And until we visit again next time, I always remind you to honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Until then, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You're listening to What Women Must Know with my guest today, Dr. Georgia Eve. Have a great week. Bye for now.